Welcome to Stargate SG Fun, a podcast where we discuss the Stargate series and some other things along the way. Today is a special episode because we're going to discuss the movie Stargate and do a first season wrap. I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm David Schaub.
And joining us today is Mandy Self.
Hi, I'm Mandy.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little bit about your connection and interest to the Stargate series, please?
Sure. So I think I was in the second grade when the movie Stargate came out. And I did not get to see it in theaters because obviously that I would have been too young. I don't remember what. So I don't remember when I first saw it, but I remember that Sci-Fi Channel would play it all the time. And I just loved it. I would be addicted to the screen literally every time it came on. It was one of my favorite movies, when I was a kid. I actually didn't start watching SG-1 till later because, we didn't have Showtime. And so when I did start watching it, it was when it was in syndication and I literally watched the entire show out of order. and there was a long period of time where, when Sci-Fi Channel started playing the show, it was season 7, and they only had the rights to show season 1 through 5. So there were like years where I'd never seen season 6. So it was just a kind of random experience. But Stargate SG-1 was literally my favorite show, as a kid, and, also has like super influenced my life. Samantha Carter is a major role model for me, and I actually work, for the Air Force Research Laboratory. I'm a civilian engineer. So, yeah, I am where I am today because of Stargate.
Excellent. Okay, so we're going to have a lot to talk about today, but we're going to get started just talking about the movie, and then we'll move on to comparisons and other points of discussion. David, would you remind us all what happens in the movie?
Lots of stuff. Aliens were on Earth 10,000 years ago. A Stargate is unearthed in 1920s Egypt by Catherine's father. Presently, Catherine offers a translation job to an academically ridiculed Jackson. Jackson figures out the gate address symbols. First MacGuffin down. A sad sack O'Neill is brought in to lead a suicide nuke mission, and they gate to the unnamed Abydos. Hijinks ensue, and Jackson is seen as an emissary from Ra by the slave miners. Jackson gets a surprise wedding with his gift bride, Sheree. But luckily for him, she's the smartest person on the planet and knows forbidden writing. She leads them to Earth's gate address. Second MacGuffin down. Jackson magically comes up with the Abydos symbol. Third MacGuffin down. O'Neill and Jackson return to the gate, but are captured by Ra. Ra heals Jackson after he's been shot to use as an example by executing O'Neill and the others. But Sheree plans a revolt. The revolution starts. The nuke timer is running. Sheree is killed. Jackson gets her healed. Ra decides to leave, but as Jackson and Sheree escape, O'Neill sends the nuke back up to Ra. Ra's destroyed. The heroes win.
And they all live happily ever after.
Yay.
I watched at least the first season of Stargate before I ever saw the movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I picked up, I didn't have any trouble following what was happening in the series. But where did y'all come in relation to the movie and the series?
So I was an adult at the point when the movie came out, and I believe I just watched it in the movie theaters. And then I must have had a subscription to Showtime, or somebody in my household did. And so I watched the show when it came out, and one of the things, and we talked about this in the first episode, one of the things that I really liked was how the show took elements from the movie, sort of took over the movie, but adapted it to what it needed in a really nice manner. It's interesting. The movie for me was not that, like, it wasn't something, it wasn't a favorite movie. I probably didn't think it was as good as, you know, like other childhood science fiction, you know, like Star Wars or Star Trek. Touchstones like that for me, but you know, it was decent. It had some good stuff in it, and so it was really that adaptation that drew me into the show, rather than the fact that I thought the movie was kind of the best thing ever. And some of the things we're going to be talking about today were in my mind even back then, that like, oh yeah, this is kind of problematic for certain reasons. But I did see them in order, and I saw them, you know, that kind of year or two apart. Like the movie was 94, and I think the show was maybe 97.
Yeah,
that sounds right.
So it was a couple years later that they kind of got their act together about making a show about it. And that did kind of feel natural going from one to the other like that.
David, what order did you see them in? Oh, well, I guess we know that.
As a function of the podcast, it's pretty obvious. Yeah, so I did see the movie first. I do not remember when. It was a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
Sometime in the 90s.
Right.
So I had seen it quite a while ago. And for some reason, I never actually watched Stargate SG-1. But of course, my next Stargate was watching Atlantis and then Universe. Mm-hmm. So my experience is strange. But now I'm going back and watching SG-1. So, and this is the first time I've seen the movie since watching SG-1, which certainly made it interesting trying to piece it all together.
Put it together, yeah.
I did want to say one more thing. As someone who watched this as a kid and was very attached to it, I don't know if you guys have seen the Disney movie Atlantis.
Yeah, yeah.
But that movie offended me as a child because I remember seeing that movie in theaters and being like, ranting. And of course, that movie came out, I was like 10. And I was like, this is a ripoff of Stargate. How dare they? Like, and like my friends being like, oh, I liked Atlantis so much. And me being like, this is trash. Like, you need to see the original. How dare you like this movie? I was a very opinionated child. And I think it was only like this year that I was finally able to make my peace with Disney's Atlantis. So that's a hot takes from Mandy.
I guess I'm going to have to watch that movie. I'm only offended because we all know that it was really the mutant apocalypse that made the pyramids.
Well, the thing is about the Atlantis movie is that every story beat is almost beat for beat Stargate. Like, it is astounding. You have Milo, who's presenting in his ideas, and he's getting laughed out until a woman approaches him about a mission that, you know, oh, the military is involved with this mission. But of course, they need Milo's secret knowledge to get to where they're going. And oh, it's beat for beat Stargate. It is ridiculous.
I got to watch it again now. It's funny. Yeah, because I remember those elements, but I had never really put them together like that.
To be fair, there's a host of white savior films that this movie is kind of beat to beat for, Matt.
I mean, that's true. But I think it was just like the everything from like the being disgraced out of his community to like being picked up to a military group. Yeah, yeah. It was just.
Yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say that there is no element in this movie, no single element in this movie that has not already been done to death by other movies. Like they stole from everywhere to make this movie. And so.
Okay, so that's some general impressions. Let's go ahead and dive on in into the movie, discussing themes first, and or themes and details in whatever order you prefer, really. Mandy, why don't you go first, since we're all interested to hear your fresh views that we have not been chewing over for the last few months.
Indeed.
Well, obviously, I love this movie, but I did rewatch it yesterday. I don't know. I just still really enjoy it. Obviously, I think there is a problem with female characters in this movie, which is that they don't exist, you know, outside of like a girl in Mission Control. And I mean, Catherine's there at the beginning, but there's just so many plot holes, I guess I'm going to say, in this movie that, you know, we forgive, but on watching it, I'm just like the Earth symbol, right? It is the only symbol on the entire Stargate that looks like that. The only one. All the others kind of look like these weird constellation-y, could be some language thing. The Earth symbol is completely distinct. So you go to another planet, you're trying to figure out that other planet's symbol. You should just look at every symbol on the Stargate.
Should we just cover the Stargate science now?
Sorry, I know that's not really themes. I don't know themes. Sorry.
Stargate science is definitely a theme of Stargate.
I mean, the first season, it takes a lot of its plot, not a lot, but a decent number of its important plot elements from extrapolating from the movie's premise. So yeah, it's definitely a thing. So David, yeah, if you want to go over it now, let's go over it now.
Okay, let's go over this. Yeah, there's a reason in my recap I call them MacGuffins in the movie, because yeah, they're ridiculous. There is one MacGuffin that is realistic, which is the Earth address home. It is funny that you have a phone system, but of course, as soon as you make a call, if you don't know your home phone number, you can't go home. But that works. that works. And you, in theory, they could have the Stargate Network have caller ID, which would make it a lot easier. But they don't. That's fine. That MacGuffin makes sense.
Does it, though?
But, Mandy, you're absolutely right that the origin symbol makes no sense. They know it doesn't make any sense. It would only have taken 39 tries to get it right. I think they could have done that in 2 years. It's bonkers. And it being the weakest MacGuffin on the way back, where Skara happens to be doodling something, and that solves the problem.
Just the fact that it's so similar to our symbol that they should have been able to see it by looking with their eyeballs at the Stargate.
And the fact that both of these symbols happen to be what the gate room looks like outside at some point in time during the year, depending on the orientation of the moons. Like, it's just it's crazy land. I'll make an argument that the show tried to answer some of these problems. There's some science, gate science problems the show tried to answer. The first one was a very correct one, which is they watched this movie and they said, how in the world did they dial the gate back home? Because there's no DHD in the movies.
Nothing.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just entirely unexplained how the gate actually got dialed. So the show fixes that. But they don't really deal with the origin issue.
I really like the gate prop better in the show as well. Like, in the movie, it doesn't do that thing where it latches and lights up, so you know a chevron is locked. I'm like, how do they know which chevron is which chevron? Like,
well, they've got those fancy computers, which are totally crazy. Yeah.
I just really like that in the movie, in the show, like when a chevron is locked, it's lit.
Yeah.
You know it's locked.
Satisfying thunking sound, yeah.
Yeah. Where in this, I'm like, what does it even mean that the chevron is locked? It like went out and came back.
It is definitely better done in the show. I think they just liked the visual effect of the lights and it was a good choice. So I was debating what I would have done when trying to refix the show. Because what else do you do when you podcast about a show?
Let's save fixing the show and just talk a little more about the movie right now.
Okay.
Then it'll be easier, I think, to get into the nuts and bolts. For me, the movie, the salient, well, one of the points is that out of the cast of characters, Daniel is the only person that I really identify with at all. There's Daniel the scientist and the military people and the locals and Ra. And out of all those, you know, of course I'm going to gravitate towards Daniel. Just to slide quickly over to the show, there are a lot of people I can identify with little points in, but here in the movie, it's basically all Daniel for me.
Like in the show, he's kind of a jerk in a lot of ways that we see over and over again. He's also lovable, but he's kind of a jerk. And I love that the movie, that they basically took that from the movie, right? Like he gets into this mess by promising something he absolutely should not have promised them without any caveats at all. And they're mad at him. And I love that the scene where they're mad at him because it's realistic in that sense. I just love that, you know, he's smiling and he's friendly and he's your friend, but he's totally a jerk and totally, you know, too confident of his own abilities. And gets them into trouble, and I just love that that's part of the plot, and that's part of how they go through things.
But they don't believe him. Like, I don't understand why they would believe him. And in the so there's we should briefly get into it. There's actually like four or five different releases of this movie, and they have subtly different cuts. So I watched the extended version, which is I think the director's cut may or may not be exactly the same. And they actually changed some lines. And when Jackson says that he can figure out their way back, O'Neill turns away. And there are different words that O'Neill says because they can ADR the words in because you don't have to see his face. And in the version I saw, I was like, O'Neill does not believe him at all. So I think the reality is West and O'Neill don't believe Jackson at all. They don't believe they can get him back particularly. And it's just the rest of the troops are being lied to.
So the idea was that he was going to blow up. He was going to send the bomb, blow it up the bomb, and just everyone was going to die over there. That's more bleak than I was Yeah, that's more bleak than I was thinking.
O'Neill's a bleak guy in this movie.
Well, he's basically suicidal, right? He wants to die. That's why they brought him back. Like, it makes no sense they brought Colonel O'Neill on this mission, right? It makes right. no sense they brought him to the Stargate.
A drunk,
basically. They reactivated him before Daniel solved the problem. Why? Why did they reactivate him? That doesn't make sense. They just need him for – they need a suicidal person, which is – fine, plot reasons. But I find it very frustrating that they all just believe Daniel and not a single person asks, how do you plan to get us back? Like, you know, what is your plan? I'm telling you, I work for the Air Force. You're not going anywhere without at least 10 PowerPoints to prove your point. Like, it's just not how things work. And no one would be willing to kill that many people on a I think I can get you back.
Yeah. Oh, Mandy, you're bringing way too much realism into this discussion. I mean,
if they were just sending Colonel O'Neill and Daniel Jackson, then I might believe it, right? You might be willing to kill, like, one other guy. Because you know Colonel O'Neill wants to kill himself. But they brought, like, a whole platoon of guys. That's probably a misuse of that word. I'm sorry. They brought a lot of guys.
Yeah. A squad of some sort. Yeah.
Like a dozen?
Yeah.
A dozen guys?
Yeah. It's just... Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense.
They were treated like fodder in the movie for the most part.
Yes.
Having read the novelization, because Amazon has dropped Stargate and the movie, I've seen the movie twice, once quite a long time ago on TV and once in October or so when we were getting started on this. But it's gone now from what I stream, so I... got the Stargate novelization that I picked up at a library used book sale a while ago. And it is a novel by Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich. I think this can be pretty well taken as the intent of the film that you don't see all of in the film. I get to see what's going on behind some of the faces, you know, with some of the thoughts that are crossing their minds and stuff. So that was interesting, digging behind the scenes a little bit, as at least to the filmmaker's intent.
Well, is there anything that you can that comes to mind at the moment?
Yeah, what do they intend?
Sure. The most crucial difference that comes to mind is when Daniel is being forced by Ra to kill the squad, or whatever they are, to kill his compatriots in order to show the locals that Ra really is a god and they should not even think about being disloyal to Ra. Ra has said, if you don't do it, then I'll kill you and all of the people who have witnessed you. So basically, he's talking about massacring the entire population.
I feel like that was in one of the cuts, because I feel like I remember that.
Yeah, I got that.
Those lines were, but what's in the novel is that Daniel actually thinks that the thing he has to do is kill his compatriots so that all the locals will survive the greatest good. And his hesitation is just that he's trying to nerve himself up to do it because he's never killed anybody before. Before, it was like, when I saw the movie, it was like he can't figure out what to do, or, you know, he's trying to figure out how to get out of this situation. But in the book, he has decided he's going to kill them. And he's just trying to nerve himself up to do it.
I wonder if they had to give him staff weapon lessons to do that, though. Like,
yeah, he uses it perfectly. I mean, I was actually, this time around when I watched it kind of last night, I was kind of looking at James Spader's face when he was in that scene. And I think that comes across. I think that comes across. Like, he's moving towards Jack O'Neill and everyone else. He's got the weapon out. He's got the weapon ready. He's kind of hesitating, but he's going to it. He's not just hanging back and not planning on doing it at all. No, I think that's actually one of the better moments of the movie was, you know, he's in this impossible situation. Mm-hmm. He has to make an impossible choice and he can't do the right thing. And, you know, yeah, I think the movie intended to show that he would have done it if Skara had not, you know, used a little lighter to signal him that they were going to do something about it.
Or more accurately, he was saved by his wife because Sharai planned the insurrection.
Well, yes. His wife. Yeah.
She's the one who brought them the idea that they could
Absolutely.
Rebel.
Like, Shara is an amazing, like, I would agree, going back to sort of what characters you get into the head the most of. And I agree that mainly because Daniel is the only person who can talk to anyone. That's the big difference between the TV show is because they try and play fair with the language. It means O'Neill can't really do much of anything in the show. Jackson is the only person who's actually talking to people. He can talk to Raw. He can talk to the locals. So you get that from Shara. But I was amazed watching this, how important Shara is to the plot.
She's and much better
really,
in the movie.
She really solves most of the problems.
She is much stronger in the movie than she is in the television show.
Oh, like, by
far. But I do want to say with Colonel O'Neill, I've always liked the Colonel O'Neill character. I mean, he's my favorite in SG-1, so that definitely colors it, right? Because it's hard to divorce that. But he does have a small character arc that I feel like
he does.
I mean, this might be skipping ahead. That does tie to the show. Like at the beginning of the movie, he's completely given up on life and he's completely devoid of hope. And by the end of the movie, he's gotten his humor back. He's gotten his ability to connect with and see other people again. And it's small, but it is there, right? Like that moment when, I'm just going to call it a Jaffa, pulls down his hood, in the temple and he like says, "Hey, how you doing?" and winks at him. Like Colonel O'Neill at the beginning of the movie would not have done that. So he's found a reason, not even a reason to live. He's found life again. Like he doesn't necessarily have a reason to live, but he at least knows how to live again.
O'Neill has the one quip, I would argue, in the entire movie, which is, "Give my regards to King Tut."
Yes, I love that line.
A debatable whether that's actually funny. But
it's not really funny.
It's funny.
It doesn't have to be funny. It's just perfect.
Well, but it is the only bit where I felt you really saw O'Neill in it. And otherwise, he is just kind of sad and around most of the time. And Kurt Russell doesn't do a bad job. There isn't a lot there for him to work with, I find, other than being grumpy and being a bad dad, showing people how to smoke.
Well, I do think – I actually really like Kurt Russell's casting here because he can pull off hyper-masculine and hyper-military, you know. And you just look at his hair when he first comes back when he's got the uniform on, and I'm like, that would be a CGI effect if it weren't obviously real. Like, his hair is perfect. And like, you know, this perfect coif of it. But he, you know, so he can be hyper-masculine. He can be gruff. He can be emotionless. But he also has to, you know, his arc is connecting with Scar. Like that's the whole thing is Scar opens him up again. And Kurt Russell is known for playing, you know, certain masculine roles, action hero roles. But he's also known for playing, I don't know if comedies or romantic movies. Like he's done other stuff where he's had to actually act. And I think bringing him in with that, having an actor who can be, who can open up, who can show vulnerability to people. Like, you know, there's some moments in the middle of this where he's showing real emotion and he's showing that he's kind of at his last thread about things and doesn't know what to do. And I do, you know, he doesn't get that much of an arc, but he does get an arc and it's pretty satisfying. And again, I liked that he was this dual role or triple role or whatever. He showed a number of different sides to his character throughout, and I really liked his casting, especially in hindsight. And I also want to talk about casting in general, so maybe this is a good time to go through it. I have a whole long list. Catherine Langford, played by Vivica Lindforce, and I've talked about this before. She's played by Elizabeth Hoffman on the show, and I think both of them are good in their own ways. I think Vivica Lindforce was kind of trying to be, they were kind of have sort of more of exotic, mysterious figure, you know, approaching Jackson. Ridiculously not telling him anything about the details of the job, but just kind of making it this mysterious, "You will come with me because I know all about your life." And, you know, it works, but it's silly. And she, you know, she pulls that off pretty well. And Alexis Cruz is, you know, plays Scar both in the movie and in the show. And, you know, we saw in Within the Serpent's Grasp that he's got a lot of range. He can play a Gwold. He can play the Scar. And he's good here, too.
I do have to say that his wig in the movie is so much better than his wig in the television show.
The budget shows.
The wig in the television show is like its own character, practically. It's just like it's eating his head. I don't know.
Well, that's another thing about the movie versus the show. The movie feels like kind of a movied up version of the show. Like the credits are more elaborate. The CGI is better. The uniforms are better. The costumes are better. Sarcophagus is better. Just like everything is kind of, you know, and of course the movie came first, but, you know, everything is a more expensive version of what the show tried to do later.
There
and,
are so many extras they can kill off.
There are so many extras. We will get to the extras. But, you know, and that's about, so, you know, Millie Avital, might be pronouncing that wrong, as Shauri instead of Vaitiara Bandera in the show. She is great. She single-handedly, I think, saves a lot of this movie because she takes a role that is thankless and imbues it with what feels like sort of real emotion. And like, you can see what she's thinking, even though she doesn't say a whole lot, and her mm-hmm. kind of vulnerability with Jackson in these scenes. It just really, and of course Jackson's behavior, maybe we'll get to more of that later, but you know, Jackson's behavior is not necessarily all that admirable. It's somewhat admirable, but it's.
Well, and I think the Shauri in the movie also just, I feel like she has a quiet dignity about her all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas the Shauri in the television show, I feel like her whole character was just to be in love with Daniel. And she lost the personality of Shauri.
Yeah. They really would have done, I think they could have done better in the show. But, and so again, the movie version is great. Kowalski in the show, played by Jay Avicone or Avicone. Played in the movie by John Deal. And I don't know if the rest of you were like this, but I totally recognized that actor. He was in Miami Vice as Detective Zito. So I totally knew, you know, I was like, hey, I know that guy. And, you know, he played another kind of, he was not really playing much beyond a standard military guy in the movie, but it was still kind of funny to see somebody I knew.
Just pausing for that for a second. In the novelization, Kowalski is simmering with resentment throughout most of the book because he had been, you know, in command of the expedition. And then this O'Neill guy is put in charge of him and making what seem to be all these irrational decisions because he doesn't realize that this is a suicide mission.
Yeah, no, John Deal is just such an easygoing. It feels like he's such an easygoing actor that he wasn't. They probably didn't give him.
I definitely didn't get resentment from him in the.
oh, he resented Jackson. Boy, does he hate Jackson at the beginning of his life.
Everyone resents Jackson,
but not O'Neill. Well,
wasn't the one who was more resentful is Ferretti. And again, Ferretti is also in the show, played by Brent State. But here he's played by French Stewart, who played Harry Solomon in Third Rock from the Sun, which is just so random. That this, you know, he was in this and then he was also in that. Of course, he was in Third Rock after this, as opposed to The Man Vase, which came a long time before this. But I loved French Stewart's acting in this one. He's the one who kind of pushes Jackson, right? He throws the suitcase at him and is like, you idiot. And I just like, you know, he again, very small role and mostly just playing a military guy. But I just thought it was funny that, you know, there was another one of those, hey, I know that guy. And then the big casting choice, which again I want to spend some time on if we have time to do it now, is Jay Davidson as Ra. Mm-hmm. And unlike a lot of these other actors who, you know, were kind of been doing other things and we know them from other places, Jay Davidson was known for only one role before this. He had not acted before that, known for his role as a transgender woman in The Crying Game 2 years earlier. And it is absolutely, it feels like it's absolutely a deliberate choice to have him play Ra here. Because Ra is supposed to be kind of an exotic figure, a menacing figure. All of the enemies here, the guards, Jaffa possibly, here are kind of placed in opposition to sort of the uniformed, manly men of the Earth Force. Against that are these people in much more elaborate costumes, bearskin, jewelry, and Ra especially comes across, again, you can tell me if you think this is a valid reading of this, but coded feminine. He kind of slinks around in the way like a femme fatale would, but he's got this deep voice. And like, maybe they weren't really thinking about the fact that they were exploiting that in the front of their mind, but they were obviously exploiting that somewhere in their choice for how this was going to work, how they were going to make something exotic and menacing and different than the good guys. And it's just, you know, I think it's easy to let that slide. It's easy to let that slip when you don't want to think about real world associations with these sorts of things. He does play the role well, I think. He is menacing. I like the scene with him and Jackson, but it's just dangerous to be using those sort of symbolism, to use those sort of visuals, you know. And also he's not entirely white, you know, so there's some race exoticism going on here as well. Just there are a lot of bad choices in terms of setting this up, and I wanted to be sure that we talked about it.
I will add a possible support to your hypothesis, which is that I have read he didn't audition for this role. It was offered to him, yep. And he didn't much want to do it. So he named through his agent some ridiculous sum of money, thinking that that would put them off. And they said yes and paid him anyway. So they definitely wanted him for this part. It was not an accident.
I didn't know any of that history. So, I mean, I'm not saying that that's definitely, I can definitely see how it comes across that way. But I guess to me, it was always more of, he was like, more like Kirsten Dunst in Interview with a Vampire, like the child with elder knowledge. Because, you know, they say in the story that he is a young boy who is brave, who went forward and Ra took him. So the creepy right. thing to me was not that he was effeminate, if he is. It was that you have a teenager who has the knowledge of the ancients. And I thought that was put in direct contrast to Colonel O'Neill, who I would say in the show's kid is older than he is. I mean, in the movie, his kid is older than he is portrayed in the show, which I would say his kid who died was closer to a teenager, like 12 to 13. Is that, you know, he could have killed him a couple of times and he doesn't. And I think that's also alluded to as to when Colonel O'Neill calls him King Tut, because King Tut was the child king. So I always took it as he was the child villain, but he's not a child because he's an alien, because he's a parasite. Now I can definitely see your interpretation. So I mean, I just didn't have that context for that at all. I've never seen The Crying Game. And once again, I saw this when I was like, 7. So
right. So this was something that they meant to be part of how the audience at the time saw it, but that has been lost. And I would argue that that is not so bad that that's been lost about that, right?
And really, I will also say that the trope, I agree with you, Andrew, that there's issues there. And another aspect of that trope, which I think is very questionable, is that basically all of his servants are all
kids,
basically yep. tween kids yep. in very little clothing also, which also feels tropish and gross. So, I mean, he's a bad guy. He's supposed to be gross, but they're edging into tropes to show grossness that are inappropriate in some regards. So there's challenges the show has. It has different tropes than the TV show, which is more purely sexist in its view of roles, but I don't know which is worse.
Yeah. Now, the one thing to say about the movie is that they play it completely straight. Like, it could have been a lot more campy than it was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. Like, the scene, I kept looking for it in the scene with Ra and Daniel, but it's really just this sort of standard, you know, confrontation, dangerous, you know, ominous confrontation between the, you know, the bad guy and the good guy. And it's played straight. And it's also, you know, again, the show gets a lot of its ideas about the Gua'uld, about this enemy race, about their arrogance, about the way they make it all about themselves and yet are kind of stupid about a lot of things. And the movie does a lot of that too. And again, they do some of it because they need to, because if this alien were really as smart as he was powerful, they never would have won.
Right. They're in the novelization, Ra is playing games and he's kind of aware of the revolution, but he is bored. And so he's kind of seeing how far it goes before he brings the hammer down. And then he ends up not being able to pull it off.
Miscalculating them. Yeah.
I will say, you know, aside from the danger of the trope of having a ambiguously gendered character be a villain. Putting those implications aside, I think that Jay Davidson does a great job playing a dangerous and disturbing alien, and arrogant, power usurping, manipulative god. So I don't think any of us are saying that Jay Davidson shouldn't have been cast in this movie. He does a great job. It's just that the implications are unfortunate.
I also think it's interesting that they could have, in that scene you're talking about with Daniel and Ra, they could have made it weirdly sexual. And right, I say weirdly because he's like a kid, and you know, but they didn't. They play it like Ra has no sexual interest that we can tell in the movie in humans, which I feel like they do differently in the show, not necessarily to the benefit of the show.
Certain episodes, yeah.
But to me, it makes complete sense that like he is an alien. He has no interest in humans other than what humans offer him, right? Which is not sexual. It's literally like manpower, you know, like protection and slavery and that kind of stuff, right? So I thought that was really interesting watching it again.
And really, I also would just point out his costumes are great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the costumes and the costumes are fun. The you know, so he's got a lot of this jewelry, like, and it's kind of all of a piece, right? Like he comes out of this sarcophagus and the first shot of him is his hand coming out of it. It's kind of both ominous and kind of sexy-ish, kind of like they're definitely playing on certain tropes in that regard. But, you know, he's got this very opulent pyramid that he lives in, and his guards mm-hmm. are dressed very opulently. And those helmets, those Horus helmets are just like amazing. Like they really look kind of
they're amazing,
they're great,
beautiful,
they're threatening
done.
And they're beautiful, yeah the whole thing. So I do think that they get pretty high marks for you know, if you're gonna make an exotic enemy based on foreign cultures, you know, they did as well with that. I think it's, they were going to. Oh, and then how that all plays into the show as well. Like there are a lot of things that they do in the movie that they also do in the show. Like the eye glowing, which is both there in the show and the movie, and entirely different in both,
yeah.
because he uses it for a completely different set. Like he accents different things when he's doing it in the movie versus what they do in the show, but it's still great. And then the hand device, which is used for exactly the same things in the movie as it is for the show, and the staff weapons and the gliders and the pyramid, and just they took so much from the movie that worked pretty well. So much of the science fiction aspects of it from the movie that they just used pretty much directly in kind of, you know, a bit of a cheaper show fashion than the movie was able to do.
So my big question about Ra in the movie was I never understood why he allowed Earth to rebel. I could understand you losing like control. I can understand you even losing the gate. But in the movie, he clearly has a spaceship. And he clearly travels about with it. And so I'm like, why? And if Earth is this important, if all humans come from Earth, and of course, when you take it in the context of the show, it becomes even more ridiculous, because why would the system lords who have all been to Earth allow Earth to disappear from their control? And I mean, in the show, you can say later it falls under, I won't say anything, never mind, because spoilers. you know, there's other powers at play in the universe in the show. But in the movie, it's just like, why did Ra let Earth go? I just don't understand.
What is the thing you use on the Supergirl podcast? Doylist reasons? Right, like they
right.
they did it because they had to do it for the plot, right? And you just kind of have to wave it away. But yeah, absolutely, absolutely worthwhile plot holes in how that happened. Yep.
Now, there is also the difference between the TV show and the movie. Is one of the things the TV show very wisely did is they shrunk the world down a little bit by having the Stargate system only operate inside of a galaxy.
Yeah.
Now, we don't actually know if they can fly from the other side of the universe to Earth in their spaceships, because they're in a different galaxy in the movie.
Right. In the book, it definitely states that Abydos is in a different galaxy from the Milky Way.
Do they call it Abydos in the book?
I don't remember. The planet where Ra is.
It's one of so many things that they don't give names
to. So he's not limited to Abydos and Earth in the movie. In the novelization, he flies around in his pyramid spaceship. But for some reason, he never came back to Earth.
I'm just saying it's possible it would take him 1,000 years to do that.
Yeah,
right.
In the movie.
Well, that would also mean that he didn't have the ship on Earth, which then why would they build the pyramids to be landing pads if they didn't have the ship?
That was 10,000 years ago.
Well, and what's the Stargate for? What like, if we only see Ra travel via ship in the movie, we never see Ra use the Stargate.
That's true. Yeah, the Stargate is oddly not pivotal in the movie that has the name Stargate.
Stargate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the ring transports are much more important to the plot.
I do love those ring transports.
Aren't they great?
They're awesome. They're so good.
Yeah.
But anyway, I will give it to them, though, because they have Ra showing up in Egypt at 8,000 BC in the extended version. They actually put that label on it. So that was 10,000 years ago. And it may have taken him 1,000 years to fly to Earth. He then left. The Stargate was set up there, and he was not going to spend another 1,000 years to get there again. So it's conceivable that it's just flying there is such a pain, it wasn't worth it.
I'll allow it.
Well, I want to talk about was sort of the premise of the movie is this sort of ancient astronaut theory, this idea that the ancient cultures on Earth were invented by alien races. And this is a conspiracy theory, right? It's not true, in case anyone's wondering. And it's also, pretty racist, this idea that, well, these alien, generally non-white cultures couldn't possibly have done all these technical achievements that they actually did. It must have been aliens. And so it's, again, it's this problematic root of the entire show that we just kind of accept. And it's fine to accept it, but I just do want to highlight that, wow, this is not just an unproblematic little fantasy. This is a bad idea. This is something that, bad people kind of thought of and propagated. And yet it's the root of the show. And it's also the root of shows like Battlestar Galactica. Like it's the root of more shows than you would think. In what we think of as the sci-fi sort of pantheon.
Well, I mean, I know ancient aliens is an idea that in a lot of ways was created by racists, but you can take these ideas and all ancient cultures, none of them were white, none of them. at least with the Stargate SG-1 show, it seems to give every culture to the Goa'uld, which I find mind-boggling, that they go to planets and there's, like, Romans there. I don't even know.
Yep. Mongols.
We'll get there.
Yeah. It boggles the mind. What I always thought was interesting about Stargate was that they attribute, like, all of Earth culture to aliens. All of it.
It is interesting also that in the show they try and present it that the aliens pretended to be Egyptian gods, where the movie is far more clear of, no, the Egyptian gods are aliens.
Right. Yeah.
And to me that, of course, makes more sense because the Goa'uld would never pretend to be anything they're not.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that that makes a lot more sense that the Egyptian gods are based on the Goa'uld than the other way around, which is – part of the problems the show has then when they try to expand to other cultures like, Mesopotamia and stuff. And it's just like, this doesn't make any sense.
Well, and the, we might as well see if we can talk about this here is the idea of the fact that there was this culture that was based on ancient Egypt that had been unable to free itself until, the good-hearted, strong, earthlings, Americans were able to come in and save them and tell them what they would never have thought of on their own and lead them to victory in their rebellion. you know, and again, sort of this white savior. I think, again, if you look at some of the wikis, the fan wikis, you know, they talk about how Devlin, either Devlin or the other one, forgetting, thought of this as a Lawrence of Arabia, you know, alien Lawrence of Arabia, right? And it totally is. Like, it's totally getting a lot of its imagery from kind of the desert, white savior in the desert, in the Arabian desert idea.
And even the music is very similar.
So, you know, you want to look at that as well. I do think, you know, David, like you were saying, you know, having a Shari play such a pivotal role in kicking things off is good. Having the fact that basically the way they actually succeed in the rebellion is having lots and lots of people overwhelm the like three guards that Ra has. Like, Ra has maybe like 10 guards total in his entire pyramid, which has always struck me as being weird. You know, so even the Western folks with guns were not the pivotal moment with any of this. But still, this idea that they were what was needed to make it work is another sort of problematic thing that I wish they had examined a little more in the show instead of just doing it.
Also, adding to that, with Sharae, there's a little bit of colorism at play as well, because she is definitely lighter in skin tone than her father or brother. And right. it's like, oh, yes, for this to be a romantic love interest for Daniel Jackson, she can't be, you know, that brown, right? You know, you gotta, and it's like, yeah, that's not cool, guys. You know,
one would hope they would not have to do that now, but
no, I have no faith. Yeah.
Well, if I was redoing this whole show now, I probably would have made, you know, Daniel Jackson actually female, and, you know, gone a lot of different ways.
Absolutely.
Danielle.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, and that's another, as we're not sure we've touched on that much yet, is the whole marriage thing. Like, I do feel that that's also kind of a trope of things like that, where, you know, the white visitor is like entrapped in marriage or something, or part of a ceremony that they don't understand.
Whereas the reality is that white visitors far more often would participate in local marriage rituals just to get what they wanted and then abandon their brides.
Yeah, exploitation would be a much more common thing for to happen with these sorts of visitors. And the fact that, you know, the fact that Daniel, when he is finally told that this has happened, instead of saying, oh my God, why did they do that to you? Of course, that's wrong. You should live your own life. You know, decides to have sex with her anyway. My
headcanon is all they did was kiss. And then he has a long conversation with her about the freedoms of women.
in the book, the first night that they spend together is platonic. Okay. He just does not send her away because he doesn't want to shame her. And only after she leads him to the writing and he figures out the way home. And, you know, she is an active figure in that and obviously intelligent. Only after that do they kiss.
They try and make it better that way, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it is in the movie. But it's like she says... I didn't tell them. And he's like, tell them what? And she's like, that you didn't want me. And then instead of him being like, what? This is insane. He kisses her, right? When really he should have been like, oh, it's not that I don't think you're a lovely young woman. It's that this is not how marriage works on my planet. Like, there's a lot of outs he had, but he takes none of them.
they really need to present this very much like the Paul and Chani relationship from Dune. Another white savior trope storyline, mm-hmm. Where there's a strong similarity there to this. I had forgotten when first watching this movie how strong Shari's character is, because she really is the Daniel of the civilization. She is the intellectual rebel and the one learning all the secret things. So it's like they're trying to make the matching not as gross as it is, but they just don't quite fix it.
Well, yeah, I mean, they try to cinematography, like, you know, when they're entering and she's there and she keeps studying them, like they try to make it seem like she's interested in him. But it's like, yeah, she's interested in him because he's an alien. Like, that doesn't mean she like wants to marry him. Yeah. She might want to dissect him. I don't know.
her expression when they're kind of giving her to him is, you know, again, I think the actress does as good a job as is possible. Does the, you know, it's obvious that there's mixed feelings on her face. Like, she knows her duty, And she's, you know, she's ready to do what she needs to, but she's not really that happy about it, but she's determined. I do think that, again, the portrayal is really good. I also think that the movie is very, very clear with the sort of the romantic swelling music afterwards and the shots of the desert. You know, the movie's language is very clear that they had, that, you know, this was supposed to be some romantic, intimate encounter with them. Like, they're not, just because they don't say it out loud, that the language is there, it's just not verbal and what was going on. But I do also like that, you know, that scene where she and Daniel are going over the hieroglyphs and she's correcting his pronunciation such that now he knows the vowel shifts to understand the language. Like, that's some of the best part of the movie, because it's both mm-hmm. a great character moment for them. It's a wonderful linguistic moment. Like, the idea that languages evolve by having vowel shifts is totally a real thing. And you right. know, the fact that they use that to make this sort of more realistic and more interesting is great. I love that about it. And, you know, and then the fact that he's got this language that he can now speak, probably too well, but okay, such that he can then have the confrontation with Ra. Again, I just loved the way all that worked. Loved the through line of all of that.
So my question about the linguistics was, I just don't believe that Ra would allow a linguistic shift that great. He's not going to learn a new language. So I think in reality, what you would have is you would have a population linguistic shift, but you would also have a high language, right? Like a religious language that you sure. would use when speaking liturgical. With Ra, because there's no way he's going to learn your dialect. Like, that's just not how Ra operates.
But there's also just the fact that, you know, Egyptologists don't know how ancient Egyptian was pronounced. There's a whole lot of guesswork. So it's not that the language shifted from what it was 10,000 years ago. It's that Daniel never really knew how it was pronounced in the first place, as nobody knew how it was pronounced.
Unfortunately, that's not what Daniel says in the movie. But yes, I agree
true.
With you.
Oh. That's true. No, you're absolutely right.
In the movie,
right.
Daniel yeah. says it's a dialect of Haratic or something
oh, dear.
Like that.
Oh, well.
But otherwise, I would completely believe you that, yes, you know, he has no idea how ancient Egyptian is passed. I mean, I took 4 years of Latin in college and, I mean, not in college, in high school. And, you know, we just have ideas. We don't really know how Latin was pronounced.
Well, that's a good pattern for the show and in general is that, you know, there are so many, they have so many good little ideas as part of their world building, but they never quite get anything right.
Yeah.
And so
well, the movie was certainly closer in that regard. The TV show just gives up.
And the TV show, everyone speaks
well,
English.
True.
I don't, except, you know, chop eye.
Oh, that's so, it's, yeah, amazing. Well, so I think we've talked about kind of arcs. Are there any other kind of arcs that are important? Well, we talked about, Jack O'Neill's kind of arc with Skara. Why don't we talk a little about Skara then? So Skara is, you know, in the show, he's got friends, but he doesn't have – in the movie, he's got this kind of troop of boys that
his
he's
posse.
With that are – yeah, he's got a posse. And that's kind of, you know, and some of them kind of die tragically in ways that are extremely melodramatic. but are, you know, supposed to tug at the heartstrings. But he's, you know, he's part of this revolution. He uses guns. He stands up to his god. He's actually one of the first people to stare at the strangers when they come in. So I guess we're supposed to think that he's got sort of more of an independent mind than some of the other people here. Mm-hmm. You know, I like him. I like that actor. And again, I think we've seen that he has some range in the, once we saw him in the show. Any other thoughts about Skara? I think he's pretty straightforward. He's, you know, he's supposed to be a stand-in for O'Neill's son, the way that so he's kind of more a tool than a character who gets a big arc on his own. But I still like him. I like the portrayal, like the actor's portrayal of him.
What I think is interesting about Skara is that he is willing to follow his sister, which I think says something interesting about Abydonian society that. The son is willing to follow the older sister and listen to her and all that. So
well and the ships, right? So there's the ship that Ra has, which is basically a pyramid shape, basically a hollow pyramid shape kind of, because it has to land on a real pyramid. And you know, and one of the nice things about the show is that they kind of copy that from the movie, that there's that through line and in fact that scene, which is, again, a really kind of lovely scene of the ship landing at night and very ominous and a lot of, you know, lights and technology and everything, is the only thing they ever show in the clip show politics from the movie, because they can't show any people because the people are all different. But they do kind of show that piece. And I do like kind of that through line of like, well, they also have pyramid ships in the show. And of course, all the same kind of technology. So I did like that part of it.
So one other thing in the movie is that the one frustrating thing that I think, oh, there's many frustrating things, but one of the additional frustrating things they did with Sharae was that during the actual, they sneak into Ra's ship.
Yeah.
She's completely useless. They don't allow her to be useful. Daniel doesn't allow her to be useful. Like, they give her a gun, and as soon as the shooting starts, he like pushes her back. And
right.
I'm just like, you either give her a gun and let her come, or you make her stay home. Right? Like, she's either part of the team or she's not. And then her only purpose to be there is to be shot so Daniel can delay.
Yeah. Yep.
So that we have to get down to the final countdown on the nuclear bomb.
Absolutely. Doylist all the way.
Just. Yeah. The other thing, and sorry, not related, I can't make a good segue to it, but the other thing I wanted to make sure we talked about was, again, all those extras. On set, that one of, you know, there is decent CGI in this movie, but it's actually used fairly sparingly because one of the biggest special effects is merely the fact that they had a giant desert setting that they could use, you know, unlike the show, which is mostly forests. You know, they had a giant desert setting and a whole bunch of extras that they could use for a lot of these scenes. And so a lot of the grand scope of this movie is not big special effects, big ships or anything, but simply, you know, wide panning shots of lots of people doing things, lots of people mining, lots of people in lines. And, you know, again, they were kind of trying to show that it's this exotic culture and it's dehumanized. It's very much, you know, there aren't a whole lot of individuals in it. And I don't love that aspect of it. I love that this is, you know, majority of what they focused on about this culture is the fact that it was kind of primitive and whatever, all these things that I think, but it is a huge part of the movie's identity is basically that it's set in a primitive culture, in a primitive exotic culture. And, you know, without that, the movie wouldn't have a lot of the scope that it does.
Right. Well, if they had gone to a place where the culture was on a level with ours, it would have just been a totally different movie. And, you know, I you couldn't make this movie and set it in a tech level adjacent or equal to our own.
Well, Ra wouldn't allow that, right?
Right. He forbade writing even, let alone any other technology.
Well, we'll cover that when we cover some of the season one wrap, which is there are only two levels, other levels for cultures other than humanity. We're in the middle. But everyone else is either in basically abject slavery or of that, or basically the same state they were in when they left Earth, or near God. And there's nowhere in between except us. That's why we're special.
There's more later in the show, but spoilers.
Right. Just one other point about the movie I'm interested in. When I was talking about this with my sister, she says the single most irritating thing for her in the movie is when the Airmen and Daniel are exploring, they all silhouette themselves at the top of a skyline and dune and are totally visible and exposed. And that is not the way that soldiers should be exploring unknown territory. And of course, Skara does spot them immediately.
I actually remember that. Like, I think the other two soldiers with O'Neill do drop down. It's just O'Neill who's the idiot who's just standing there. And again, maybe that goes back to his suicidal tendencies. But yeah, I did thought it was funny that the other people with him were all like, down, quick, down. And he's like, yeah, whatever.
Mandy, can you give us any insights on how accurate or inaccurate or off-character military actions may be in this movie, other than the whole putting through a bomb to kill off another culture?
I would say probably the most inaccurate thing is that it's the Air Force going through the Stargate. or not even that that's inaccurate. It's that in this time period in the 90s, you don't have a lot of like Air Force acting like soldiers. Like things are very different now, because there have been like these ongoing, things in the Middle East, right? Like the wars, almost everyone, who deploys at some point deploys to like Afghanistan and things like that, no matter the force you're in. I don't think that's as accurate in the 90s, where I think the Air Force was more, there is a joke, you know, when you talk about inter-military, rivalry, that the Air Force is the chair force, because they don't do a lot of soldiering. you know, the engineering part of that residing in the Air Force and the fact that it's space, that all makes sense to me. That would fall within the Air Force. Obviously, we're just now splitting into a Space Force, which we're still figuring out. Like my group is a Space Force group, technically.
Wow.
Yeah. So I find that interesting. I think it would have been a more of a mixed group, to go through, or at least they would have to have been specially trained soldiers brought from somewhere else. Cause Cheyenne Mountain is, you know, Colorado is the heart of the Space Force. And I think that was true even in the 90s. Though obviously I'm not as knowledgeable about 90s, Air Force, but most of our space, facilities are in Colorado.
Well, of course, that's where the Stargate is.
Obviously. So that makes complete sense. You know, so in the movie, I don't really have a super lot of problems with how things go, other than, you know, them letting Daniel go without a huge explanation of how he thinks he can get back. And then obviously the nuclear bomb and the suicide mission. I find that very hard to believe. I have a lot of opinions about how the SGC is set up in the show.
Well, we can get to that.
I think that's really interesting. I also, you know, have a hard time with, you know, Catherine's in charge and then the military comes in, but it's just Colonel O'Neill who comes in and he's like, I'm in charge now. And that is not how that works. Let me tell you, if a civilian is in charge and some military guy shows up and says, I'm taking your job, that civilian is like, well, I'm going to the general. And I need to hear it from him, right? Because civilians are put in spots equal to military people, you know, over military people. Most of our supervisors are civilians and they supervise military. My position's an exception. Both of my supervisors are military. So yeah, in fact, most of our chain of command, they try to have it that your supervisor is either military or civilian, and then your deputy supervisor is the opposite. Everyone has someone in the chain of command they can go to. So my supervisor, direct supervisor, is military, but his deputy is a civilian. Yeah. So I just, there's things like that, that I'm like, the politicking in this movie doesn't entirely make sense. And obviously, I don't even know what kind of nuclear bomb we're taking through a Stargate, or why we'd allow a suicide mission. That just seems like, or why we would do that. Like, if there's any threat, blow it up, as if we can't, you know, find resources or make friends.
Yeah,
I guess I had dismissed the inner service concerns. Basically, I know that Catherine Langford sought funding for years and years and years, and maybe the Air Force was the only one that she would back her project for whatever reason. And so that would be why they were in charge of the project. And maybe the strings put on the grants were such that they could just walk in and take over. But I don't know about the structure.
I mean, it makes sense to me that research would reside within the Air Force. This is my bias coming out. Most research resides in Air Force or Navy. I just think at some point where you're going through a thing, the other people under Colonel O'Neill probably would have been like specially trained guys who go into unknown situations, like,
right, yeah,
like actual soldiers and not like random airmen you handed a gun to. And maybe it is. Maybe they are actual, because their uniforms are not super clear once they go through the gate, right? So maybe they are.
a lot of chances for fan interpretations of things, fan fiction things, to make things make more sense. You know, I did think that in the same way as the show, I think they do a good job with creating suspense and creating sort of dramatic climaxes and then resolutions for things like the ending confrontations and even some of the confrontations in the middle, I think were handled really well. You know, it's a fun movie to watch. It's a fun movie to go through. I don't think it drags very much. I also think there's some good pacing with the slowness of the raw scenes and for the quickness of some of the combats, you know, the going back and forth like that. I think they've got a good mix. And I also liked, although I thought it was funny, pretty funny at the end with the 7-minute countdown, when you have an entire revolution and an entire ship reaching orbit in like, you know, a minute and a half. And yet, of course, you don't really even notice it because the show actually, not the show, the movie actually handles those transitions pretty well and gives you that sense of drama and gives you that sense of action and flow to make it work. So, and I think the movie works for all of the many flaws that we found in plot holes and silliness. I do think it's ineffective and I think it's a fun thing. And a lot of the actors are really good. So I want to make sure I mentioned that here, that, you know, we're talking about the movie because we like it, even if we have some issues with it.
Yeah, and also the actors all pretty much sell their parts. You know, I have no problem watching them and questioning why is, other than the logic of why a thing would be done at all, I have no problem believing in these people.
People sell their characters. Yeah, they really do.
I mean, obviously, this is one of my favorite movies. So I despite all of my criticisms, I really do love this movie. And I think the show, whoever, I don't know the background of how they went from a movie to a show, but I think they saw the potential and they saw ways they could go in the questions, right? So I think it opened up a really interesting idea that obviously spanned 3 different shows.
Well, they did have one scene in there where Daniel Jackson acted like, I'll be the father, don't worry. There was a scene in there just to cover that, just a little, for no real reason.
That drives me insane. Every time I watch Children of the Gods, when they're like, well, clearly they could only have come from Abydos. And I'm like, really?
Well, I wonder, I mean, I think that the whole 6 points thing was, first of all, was ridiculous, right? Like, you don't need 6 points to find 1 point. You need 1 point to find 1 point. Or you need 6 points to find a point. I think, David, you mentioned this in some of our chat. Like, why didn't you need 6 points to do the origin then if you have 6 points to do the destination?
Sorry. So to be space for a moment, I think what they had heard at some point, they probably asked a space person. So to do any coordinates in space, you need 6 numbers. But those 6 numbers make up a point. So if you're having a standard state vector, you have your X, Y, Z, and you have your XYZ position, your velocities. So you have XYZ, you have DX, DY, DZ. And you can also have orbital elements, which are also 6 numbers. So you do need 6 numbers to know where something is in space, but it's not quite how they explained it, nor does it make sense. So yeah. I think they heard 6 numbers at one point and they were like, cool, so you need 6. Let's go.
This is where I will throw in my little Stargate science of how I think they should have transitioned to the TV show, because they definitely did transition. They added the DHDs. They don't quite know what commissioning a DHD means, but that's okay. The movie has different Stargates having entirely different symbol sets, which is entirely dropped from the TV show, which is okay, but it means the point of origin no longer really makes any sense when they actually talk about it in the TV show, because it's always going to be the one button on the DHD that isn't one of the other ones. So there's aspects that just don't quite make sense. And I would have loved when they did this, and it would have fixed some of the MacGuffins in the movie, is I think, yeah, they should have had 6 coordinates for destination and origin, and have the thing where they discover the DHDs, when they're commissioned, are programmed with their origin point. And that gives you at least a thing that makes sense. You could then hold together better, where their supercomputer, when they're dialing, they don't have a DHD, they didn't understand the commissioning, so they would then have to figure out both a destination 6 address and an origin 6 address, and then it can just use the same symbol space and not just have a magic unique symbol for each origin.
Oh, okay. That's why you
want to do that. And then when you build a DHD, you commission in, of course, where it is. So you don't have to have a senseless button that doesn't really mean anything. and then that felt it would hold together better. And the TV show tried to fix it, and they just didn't quite. So it's left in a state that so far in the first season doesn't actually make any sense either.
Well, what's interesting in the TV show is that the Stargates very clearly know where they are. So you're right. You don't need a destination point. Because if the Stargates don't know where they are, then the whole premise of Solitude doesn't make any sense, right? The Stargate knows it's on Earth.
But it has its own local gate symbol that is a different opening symbol than the one on the one used for the Earth.
That doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, you could say it's the commissioning button, but why have a seventh button? But they always press seven buttons on the DHDs. So
Well, so what I say when we talk about this in the various other podcasts is we are probably spending more time thinking about it than the showrunners did when they made the episodes. So
I bet they didn't think about it because they clearly were trying to fix up the movie. Like they there was absolutely an attempt to try and tighten up the world building, and they decided to only go so far, and they didn't want to entirely break the seven chevron.
I think they were afraid to directly conflict with the movie, right? They just wanted to add on and not be like, actually, the movie was wrong.
Right. There are a few cases where they say, you know, actually, what you thought was true is not true, but that's done in show. It's not just flatly contradicting and making up new mythology. It's you thought this, but actually that.
Right. You thought Ra was this weird, you know, gray-looking alien, but actually he's this snake in his head. So
I had forgotten how much the Ra from 10,000 years ago looks kind of like a gray. I had forgotten that much.
Yep.
Which is even weirder in the context of SG-1. So
yes,
we will leave that. We will leave that for later discussions.
Let me just mention, Mandy, you had said you don't know anything about how it went from movie to show. All I know is what I've read, that creators Brad Wright and Jonathan Glassner, the series creators, independently came up with treatments to turn the movie into a series. And the studio basically said, okay, you two work together now.
Which is kind of funny considering that I think the movie was also a combination of two different ideas that were kind of put together. But the important thing is that the showrunners were a completely different set of people than the movie people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that the movie people actually wanted to continue their movies and only relatively recently finally just said, okay, yeah, that's probably never going to work out. But the movie people are actually not all that happy about the fact that the show took over from them and sort of cut off the chance.
Back many years ago, I read a novelization, a tie-in novel that was written after Stargate, but before the movie, and it had other aliens in it, and these cat people or something. It was very bizarre because I read it after I had been watching the show, of course, and it was like there's all this stuff that's really different.
they had a whole idea, I think, about, you know, a trilogy. So there were going to be another two movies that were each in other cultures, and so then, you know, actually kind of going in the same direction the show did, but you know, big budget movies instead of. Relatively low budget TV, but yeah, I think we can probably move on to the wrap up of season one.
So, SG-1 the series. Let's do overall thoughts about season one, and then we can dive into favorite bits. Right. So I'll start. I started watching Stargate before. I watched it on I guess when it came to Fox. However long after it was, I think a gap of about 6 months or so after it aired on Showtime. So I only ever saw the Fox versions, until I watched them again on Amazon this year. And I loved the series. I found technical problems with it even back then in the 90s, but I liked that it was an ensemble, even though Jack was the leader. everybody else had different parts, and, you know, Jack wasn't always right. You know, sometimes Daniel was right, or Samantha was right instead. There was a lot of interplay. There was humor and camaraderie and fun adventures. And yeah, that was, I loved the show. I don't know if it was, I haven't ever really figured out what my favorite show of all time was, but it was definitely one of the ones that I returned to eagerly week after week, at least for the first, 6 years or so.
I already said I didn't watch Stargate in order. So when I started watching live is when it came to Sci-Fi Channel, which was season 7. And I was trying to catch up on seasons 1 through 5 simultaneously while watching season 7 and never seeing season 6 for years. Because my whole family watched the show, we bought the DVDs, we sat down, we started at season 1. It's just season 1 is a struggle. The show doesn't know what it is yet. And, you know, I noticed that in your guys' coverage, you very clearly do not cover a lot of very bad episodes, because there are a lot of very bad episodes in season 1. Yeah. And especially with the characters, I feel like they had a good lock on, they knew who Daniel Jackson was. And they didn't know who anybody else was. Even Colonel O'Neill, there's this one weird episode where they almost make him like he's Captain Kirk. He just sleeps with a girl on the planet, right? And I'm like, that is not Colonel O'Neill. Like, I don't know what's happening here. And Samantha Carter's all over the place for the first half of the season. Mm-hmm. But I feel like by the latter half, they've kind of finally figured out what they want to be and where they're going. And you see that with a lot of the seeding of the four great races and how they start ramping that up almost really fast in the latter half of the season. But I just think it took them a while to kind of figure out, like, what are they doing? Why does every male alien look at Samantha Carter in her blocky BDUs and say, this is the most attractive woman I've ever seen in my life? I don't know, but that's, you know, what the first season was.
Yeah. So just to clarify something, Mandy, you were saying that they switched to the Sci-Fi Channel in season 7. They actually switched in season 6.
Yeah. Well, I don't know why they weren't showing season 6 on Sci-Fi Channel in their reruns, but they didn't.
Well, because all right. Well, we'll talk about season 6 when we talk about season 6. But yeah, no, the big switchover was the first 5 seasons were Showtime, and then the last 5 seasons were Sci-Fi Channel. So yeah, I would totally agree. And when we were originally talking about, you know, getting David up to speed on this, you know, there were definitely episodes where, like, yeah, you don't need to watch the and the one, possibly the worst episode of the entire series, spoilers, is Emancipation, which is the next episode right after the first trilogy of episodes to get things off, that they really just screwed it up right after that. It's some of the episodes that I look back on as, you know, really fondly are actually episodes which are not necessarily as good as later episodes, but that because of certain associations, maybe I thought better of the original episode in season 1 than I did later on. That because of that, you know, and so it's been interesting getting David's reaction, not having been so familiar as I am with the rest of the show, and saying, you know, oh yeah, this is actually really kind of stupid. Like, you know, why did they do this? And this really doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's kind of true. And so I'm really fond of them. But, you know, yeah, there are definitely it you know, and it's nice to be on this trajectory, right? Because we will be on the other half of that trajectory later on. But it's nice to be on a trajectory where we can say, yes, this actually, for the good that's in this season, it's going to get even better than this. And that's fun. That's a fun place to be at.
There are just so many bad female-centric episodes in season 1. There's Emancipation. I really hate the Hathor episode. I just hate it with a passion. And it's just like they didn't know.
What did you think about Singularity?
I generally like Singularity, but I think it makes no sense that Carter bonded maternally with this child, and then they gave her to Dr. Frasier. So they should have brought Dr. Frasier to the planet with them, and then Dr. Frasier could have bonded with the child. Because I'll buy Dr. Frasier kind of, she just kind of has like, you know, she's taking care of everyone, you know, she can have a more maternal air. But Samantha Carter is not a maternal character.
Yeah, well, they said this is our woman.
It would have made more sense for Daniel Jackson to be the one who bonded with Cassandra rather than Samantha Carter.
Well, and even
you're right.
Well, they did have one scene in there where Daniel Jackson acted like, I'll be the father, don't worry. There was a scene in there just to cover.
Right, I'll babysit her. You go get some sleep.
You know, actually, it would have made more sense for Colonel O'Neill to bond with her more. Colonel O'Neill has actual experience with children. Like Samantha Carter is like a 26-year-old captain. Like, you know, she's not focused on kids. Like, I mean, I don't even know if she doesn't even have siblings. She's an only child, as far as I know. Does she have a brother?
I don't know. I can't remember.
But
well,
yeah.
One of the patterns that I came up with about the first season is that, and I think this holds true in other seasons, but I don't remember anymore, is that, you know, most of the episodes were either team based or for, O'Neill-centric episodes where he gets to chew the scenery. And there are a couple of episodes where they try to be centric on some of the other cast members in the team. And in general, they don't work that well. You know, the Teal'c with Bloodlines was just not one of our favorite episodes. And then Carter with Singularity and Enigma, where again, she's a love interest for no good reason. You know, they just don't know what to do with these characters. They don't know how to write them well. And for me, that exception is Daniel Jackson. He kind of gets two episodes. He gets Fire and Water, which was not that good. And then he gets There But for the Grace of God, which it's one of my favorite episodes of the season.
I think he just gets
to chew the scenery the whole episode, and I love it. So, you know, I think in my mind, he's kind of the only one who's not, you know, Richard Dean Anderson, who gets an episode worth focusing on him about. And that's not a great track record for the first season. And we'll see about what happens later on.
I find this season very interesting. This is a wild experiment from my perspective, in that I'm trying to podcast about a very old TV show that I've never seen. I'm also not watching all of it. I am watching the prescribed watch order for a show I've not seen. So I'm very much trusting that you guys are not pushing me down the wrong path. Occasionally it's a little rough, but I trust you guys. So this is a wild ride for me, and I really quite enjoy it. Now, as I've said before, I've watched Atlantis, I've watched Universe, so I have an idea of how the showrunners operate, and I have some trust of their world building. And a lot of this is me trying to fill in pieces that do not make any sense at the moment, as far as that world building goes. And I'm really looking forward to maybe an increased pace in the world building. We'll see if I get that. But this wasn't going to be the season for that. And that's okay. I think I'm very happy having skipped the episodes, hearing the brief recaps of them. So that's definitely been positive. I find it really fun. I also come as someone who has watched all of MacGyver, maybe twice.
Wow, really?
I have a watch order for it. There's not very many good episodes. The thing is, I found it so funny getting into this, where they go from having O'Neill be a character who is really sad because their son was shot by an accidental shooting of a gun, and they go and they cast someone who has played MacGyver, whose character is entirely initially based on having a friend being shot by a gun. So this strange pattern there, which I don't quite understand. But Richard Dean Anderson isn't a sad sack. And the thing I really like in this, while it's a very different character than MacGyver, there is the elements of sarcasm and quippiness from O'Neill that I really do quite like. And something I think I could trust, that this show is going to give me camaraderie quippery combined with very consistent world building. And the show certainly has given me that. And it's given me some scenes where the world building has been horrible, and it's been given me some scenes where the world building is just absolutely glorious. So I've been very much enjoying this. It was challenging watching the first couple episodes with Carter, where she seemed to be there to say, hey, you guys are all sexist. And then everyone else ignoring it and the scene going on.
Yeah.
But hopefully we get less of that going forward.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we want to talk about favorite things now? Favorite episodes, favorite scenes, favorite lines, or whatever. My favorite episode of the season, I think, would have to be The Torment of Tantalus.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. I really love all the world building that it brings up. I love the characterization. We learn so much more about Catherine and her past, and the new character of Ernest is introduced, and
he's great.
I think it's fascinating, the dichotomy of, you know, the fantasy life that he's built up with Catherine, and then when he meets actual Catherine, you know, 50 years after they were parted, or however long it is. I guess 40 years, probably. But anyway, it's there's some really, really great dialogue in this, and emotional beats. Now, if someone was new to Stargates, I would not say watch this episode to get an introduction to Stargate. But out of season one, yeah, I there are other episodes that I enjoy a whole lot, and that are necessary. But if for an episode to rewatch, this would be it for me.
Yeah, it's a good choice.
Yep.
So I think Andrew's going to talk about There But the Grace of God, so I'm not going to talk about that episode.
Okay.
Even though I think it is probably the best episode in this season. But I really enjoy Solitudes. I like that it both has great character moments for, like, everybody, but also that it pokes fun at itself. 'Cause there's, like, oh, it's an ice planet.
Yes.
Very clearly, this ice planet they're on. I'm also a sucker for the Carter O'Neill ship. So, you know, that's kind of the start of it, I feel like, which is kind of like a ship built on mutual respect, I feel like, which I really love. And I just feel like it's a nice, quiet episode that just does a lot of emotional work. I do want to shout out one more episode that's not a particularly great episode, but I want to say the most, in my opinion, realistic episode this entire season is Politics. And I had, like, you know, like, flashbacks watching that episode of my own life. That was not very escapist for me. And I don't want to talk about funding anymore, ever again. And I don't like it when my escapist literature talks about funding.
Interestingly, that's one of the episodes I was told to skip.
Well, it's because it's a clip episode.
What's funny, it's like half of a clip episode and half of, like, a really important plot episode. It's just an amazingly interesting episode for one that's not very good.
Well, yeah. I think Stargate is actually one of the few shows that has done really interesting things with their clip episodes, where they were like, we need to have a clip episode, but we want it to further the plot, right? So it's like you have this clip episode, but there's things in there that are actually, like, important, and there's even better clip episodes later. Yeah, I was just like, when they're, like, trying to defend their program and, like, other programs are trying to take their money, I'm just like, wow.
Well, and we talked during our podcast about it, that some of the arguments made by Senator Kinsey seem more realistic in hindsight with more recent world events than they might have even at the time. And so, yeah, it's just...
Well, what I think is interesting about Stargate is that all of our quote-unquote bad guys make sense at different points, right? Like, in Children of the Gods, the guy who's just like, we should bury the gate, I'm like, amen. Like, you bury that gate. You know, yep. If you want to be safe, that's the only way to go, right? But...
Like, they brought a bomb back, they brought a disease back, they brought a whole bunch of really dangerous things back without a whole lot of control over it, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why are we doing this again? Yeah.
Yeah, more than one disease.
More than one disease.
Because they know the ships are coming.
Which, I mean, is the reality of any large organization, whether it's the Air Force or a company, right? Like, different people have different things they want to do, and there's pros and cons to everything, right? And so our main characters obviously see the pros of going through the Stargate, but you get these guys who from the outside are like, what are you doing?
Right.
David, do you want to talk about a favorite episode first?
I have a ranked list of all of them. And of course, there's going to be some overlap, or at least all the ones that I've watched.
Yep.
So like my top episodes were written rough order, Solitudes, then Torment of Tantalus, then The Enemy Within, then Enigma, and then They're But for the Grace of God. And I think it is telling that there's some overlap. I've been saying before that it's very clear that some of these episodes, the writers focused a lot more on making the dialogue and the writing very tight than in others. And it really shows in stories like Solitudes and Torment of Tantalus. I think those episodes have easily the tightest writing of the season. And it is very impressive that they basically handle plot elements and character elements, and all of those hold very well. I find it very funny that my top three episodes are almost bottle episodes. They're basically almost one set episodes where people are just locked in a room and they have to deal with it. And I think it's interesting that those are when they really kind of focus on that writing and the characters to make it all work really well. So those are clearly my favorite episodes, and it degrades fairly smoothly till the end, where episodes like Hathor and Bloodlines don't make any sense.
Why didn't Teal'c bring his son back with him to Earth? I just have so many questions.
So many questions.
They were so close to the Stargate when they were like, oh, we should give him a Gua'uld. I'm like, the Stargate's right there.
My one from that episode is, why are they trying to take him to the Stargate when without a Gua'uld he will die? Oh, well.
So I think of the one that you mentioned that I'm not going to get to is Enigma. I think we do have a shout out that's kind of the best of the Earth encounters a superior culture, a culture with higher levels of technology and more powerful than they are, and absolutely is unable to deal with it in any useful manner. We talked about how they need to do that in order to keep the show on the keel that it's on, the fact that they don't just have super powerful weapons right away to overcome the Gua'uld. We can keep that arc going. But it's also just satisfying to see, they're just not always right all the time. Seeing them deal with failure in a way that is justified failure. And the episode where they feel the need to actually explain what an alternate reality is for everyone. So, okay. And then all the characters being a little different in certain ways and otherwise, Jack O'Neill being more of the sad sack, more of the angry person that he was in the movie, which I think is great, is a great callback. And dealing with kind of Teal'c being different and Teal'c, them. What happens when you actually do detonate that bomb in another planet? Bad things. The show is willing to acknowledge that's not the way to go. And again, just Daniel chewing the scenery. Oh, I guess I'm dead. And what's going on? His frustration, which is all him being arrogant about not paying attention to his surroundings and understanding what's going on, and being sure that he just knows everything, and then having that get taken down a peg. It's just just love how Michael Shanks acts through that. And then, at the end where he's like, they're coming, it's gonna be really bad, and he just does intensity so well. So I really did like that. And then that flows directly into the end. And again, if we're kind of doing maybe more or less, I do think that it's worth mentioning that the premiere and the season finale, while probably not on anyone's top five lists, are also just solid episodes, that have to get through a lot, and they just do it, and they do it pretty well. So, introducing everybody at the beginning of the first episode and getting to the point where Teal'c can join the team, and then at the end, introducing all this other new stuff about the ship and Corral and... that actor Alexis Cruz really gets to shine in those two sets of episodes. The fact that they did well both starting things off where they really needed to and ending things off where they needed to keep your interest, is part of why, even with this episode being so uneven, was still something that at the time, and I think I mentioned this before, that it's the reason why I kept watching it. Said, okay, this is not the best show in all aspects, but it's worth watching. It's worth keeping going with it and seeing what happens next.
Well, what I don't know is how much this show will transition from being an episodic show to a serialized show. And it's that path which I'm curious about, because Stargate, all the other shows, really like riding that line. and they tend to write it much better than most shows.
Yep.
Now, in this season, there are a lot of cases where the plot goes way off the deep end to make sure that no technological progress can happen.
Yeah.
To just an extreme episodic sense where, boy, we have to make sure we're back to zero sum before the beginning of the next episode. And I expect that'll start to shift a little. But that certainly bothered me a little bit in some of the some of this season.
Yeah. And a shout out also for Thorsheimer, which again is probably not anyone's necessarily top five list, but had a lot of good. It's funny, had a lot of good arc aspects to it. I think Kendra was a really critical part of making sure the show keeps those threads alive of what's happening to Sharae and
Kara.
Kara. Wow. Why did I just forget the name?
I actually really like Thor's hammer. And I had forgotten how early some of this stuff is seeded in the show.
Yeah.
The Nox, Thor's hammer, the torment of Tantalus. Like, I forgot that the show didn't wait to introduce the concept of the Asgard, or that there are, you know, the four great races. You have no idea what they are after the torment of Tantalus, right? But you know that this is something that's coming. I completely forgot that there was an Unas in Thor's hammer. I was like, oh yeah, the Unas.
You remember who it's voiced by?
No, I do not.
James Earl Jones.
Oh, I did not put that together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I really like the four great races. This is kind of on brand for me, but I really like the Asgard. There is actually, I mean, if anyone's listening to this that knows me else, I really like Thor from Marvel movies.
We've actually been holding back the name of the race from David because they don't actually say it in those episodes. But yeah.
It's a mythological name.
It's pretty obvious that Thor's race is going to be called the Asgard.
That's what they're called in Marvel.
I've heard the name before. I just need more context.
Yeah. Okay.
So, sorry. yeah, my love of Marvel's Thor has nothing to do with Stargate SG-1, and yet I love it all. So
yeah, they take the Norse religion thing in a completely different direction, and it's a lot of fun.
It's still also great. But that, you know, I really struggle with all of the women kind of in this season, though. They just really didn't know what to do with them. But I love the Nox, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Nox and then them coming back in Enigma was just a really satisfying, you know, again, you know, when they do world building right, they do it right. When they bring people back, they do it right. It's just a lot of fun.
So if they're called Asgardians, can I go back to calling them Talanians?
I mean, you can do whatever you want, David.
Okay.
But yeah, and again, yeah, it's interesting how frustrating it can be to be like, we can't quite go on to talk about those upcoming seasons. But I think in terms of this one, yeah, I think like uneven but promising and with a lot of fun aspects is, you know, it's actually a pretty good review of the whole season so far. And so
I think that sums it up pretty well.
It's a good foundation.
Does anyone have any other favorites? Does anyone else have any favorite bits they want to mention or favorite quotes?
I like how they keep bringing back the line, the very young do not always do as they are told.
Yep.
Makes me smile every time.
I really like how Daniel and O'Neill's relationship develops this season, because they have a lot of, you know, they don't really get along, obviously, at the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And you can see they at least like each other in Children of the Gods. But I feel like it takes all the way to there, but for the grace of God. I feel like Daniel's always struggling with, he feels like Colonel O'Neill doesn't listen to him. But in there, but for the grace of God, he has to deal with a Colonel O'Neill who actually doesn't listen to him.
Right.
And I feel like that helps in their relationship. And I feel like the Daniel O'Neill bond was one of those things that really made this show work, which you can talk about in other seasons why there are struggles. And, you know, they were struggling in this season, obviously, to incorporate Samantha and Teal'c into that, though those obviously do get way better in later seasons. I mean, Samantha Carter's my favorite character, so, you know.
Well, you are certainly welcome to come back in our wrap ups for other seasons as well. We can have a lot of fun.
I'd be happy to. I love Stargate. Oh wait, can I give my complaints about the SGC's organizational structure?
Oh yes, yes, please do share that.
Absolutely.
Look, you cannot put a colonel in charge of a 4-person team. He is way too important for that. His annual reviews would not go well. And I just don't believe it. I think that he would be in charge of all of the Stargate teams, and General Hammond would be less involved. You would certainly not be debriefing every mission to General Hammond. You would only debrief the important missions to General Hammond. Yeah. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And also, they do what a lot of Hollywood shows do, which is they don't understand that rank and age have a correlation. When the dad from Boy Meets World is a captain who's like Samantha Carter's like ex-fiance, I'm just like, how old is this guy? Like, he is way too old to be a captain. Like, I'm sorry. So, yeah. Captains are like, you know, 26 to like 34, unless you are prior enlisted, and then you can be older. But yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. So there's a lot of little things like that in the show.
One is always doomed when watching a show that you actually know something about the subject.
Yeah.
I want to call out a couple other scenes that I truly loved. I absolutely loved almost every bit of dialogue between Ernest and Catherine in Torment of Tantalus. It was amazing throughout. Those chunks of dialogue were, I think, easily the best written dialogue in the entire season. And I don't know why they're so good, but they're just so well done. And I'll point out to my favorite scene of the entire season, which is in Solitudes, when in order to argue that there should be two Stargates on Earth, Jackson points out that we're meeting cultures that were that occurred on Earth after the Stargate was buried. And that line just made me ball out laughing, because I have never expected them to drop a lantern on an obvious flaw in the – felt like a flaw in the season. And they just lanterned it and just ran with it. And I love them so much for it. That's the world building that I hope for in this show, and if they can maintain that, I'm just so happy.
I want to agree with the work that was done in Children of the Gods and The Enemy Within to transition from a movie to a series was really well done. There has to be a lot of world building to understand how we're going to go on with this as a series. And there were things that worked in or not in the movie that they had to alter and adjust to make a series possible. And I thought they did a great job with that. The Enemy Within, I thought there was some really fine characterization and acting, particularly from Kowalski. Hang on, let me look up his name and
Jay Akavone.
Thank you very much. I thought he did just a fantastic job in that episode, switching back and forth. At first, you don't know whether his motivation, whether what he's saying and doing are coming from, you know, maybe we should do this, maybe we should do that, or if it's all already influenced by the Gould that is starting to control him. And his confusion and fear later, and anger and pain, and the way he flips back and forth as the Gould is flipping back and forth control, I thought that that was just really a fine episode, and I just loved the end of it, where someone is sympathizing with Jack on the death of Kowalski, and you know, at the very end, and Jack says, "My friend died on the table."
Yeah.
It's just a great episode, and Torment of Tantalus was my favorite just because it was, I thought, richer and broader. But as a tight-focused episode, The Enemy Within is great.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
One of the things about The Enemy Within, though, on rewatch that I think is interesting is that they clearly hadn't figured out the lore of the show yet. Mm-hmm. Because they had that they removed the Goa'uld, but Kowalski was still possessed. And of course, that is never repeated anywhere else in the show and doesn't jive with the rest of the mythology. because if that's how it works, then it's like, how do the Goa'uld take on new hosts, right? So they were still kind of trying to figure out, but we forgive it because it's such a strong episode, right?
Well, what's the trope thing? Early installment weirdness, I think, is the way they put it. There's definitely some of that going on. In the first season.
Okay, well, it's been great fun discussing the movie and the whole season together with all of you.
Yeah, it's been a blast. I know when we first kind of put this together, I was kind of curious how it was going to go. Were we really going to have enough to talk about? Or is it really going to be, you know, something where we could pull enough interesting stuff out for a podcast, you know, 20 years later, right? More than 20 years later than this. And I think we have. I think it's been great.
I guess we'll just see how many more seasons we can do.
I'm actually leaving that open. Like people who expect us to now do the same thing for, you know, 9 more seasons might be disappointed. We might actually decide to cut things off before we go that far. But I am, you know, even in my own mind, I'm kind of leaving a lot of things kind of loose about exactly how we're gonna handle it. Well, you know, we'll see how it goes. We'll see what's fun. Because, you know, fun is in our name.
That's right.
Because we couldn't think of anything better. But it's still in our name. It's there.
Well, we will definitely be coming back for more podcasts discussing our favorite episodes, at least. So, thank you, David and Andrew, as always. And also, thank you, Mandy, for coming on and discussing with us.
Thanks for having me.
You certainly contributed, you know, some insights that none of us would have had, I think.
Indeed, indeed. So to speak. Indeed. Indeed.
Indeed. All right. If any of you listeners would like to continue the discussion with us, please join us on Twitter at Stargate_SG_fun. Or if you are a member of the Incomparables, the Incomparable, you can talk with us on the Slack for the members, hanging out on TV or other sub channels. And I think that's about going to do it for this time around. And I enjoyed it. I hope everybody else did.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And we'll see you next time.
You bet. Bye-bye.